It's supposed to make your life easy, or at least less full of guilt. That is, what happens is women clean the house, and they said, I forgot that corner, right? So read this article. It's written, it's essentially a summary of the notes of Pinchas Scheinberg, who's a very firm Jew, the Rav of Matzkor. And he says, you know, your face is not supposed to fall into the soup and say their name. So please read it. I'll put up more copies on the in the shul. And it's a really, it's an excellent visual idea of the one. Okay, the second thing that I handed out was an article from the Jewish Observer. I said it was gone already. This is an article, for those who are more feministic in nature, this article is not to make you, it's not going to make you happy. This is an article that is generally a critique of orthodoxy and feminism. It's very contrary. It's very contrary, but it's very good. It raises issues which, first of all, it gets it to the core of what the nature of halakhic feminism is all about. I'm talking about this article, which I don't have any more copies of, and I'll Xerox it later, but I'll give you copies next week. It goes to the core of what is the struggle between feminism and halakha. Essentially, it's a contrast. There's a problem with feminism, which maintains personal autonomy. I'm in control of my life. I make the ultimate decision. And halakha, which says that you don't make the ultimate decision, but there is a divine tradition, or partially divine tradition, which determines. And this article talks about, to a great extent, statements of some of the leaders in the quote-unquote halakhic feminist movement, and it shows the problematics of their statement. It's appeared in the Jewish Observer, which is a right-wing, a good newspaper. You have to go with realizing the slant, or the tint, or whatever it is. It appeared in color, but it seemed more appropriate for me to print it in black and white. But it's an excellent, excellent article. The questions raised are valid. And everyone who considers themselves a feminist or a fan of feminism or one of the like has to struggle with the issues raised by this article. And I'd be more than happy if you would read the article. And then maybe you can, at some point, we'll discuss some of the issues that are raised by this particular article. Okay? And the last are sources. Okay, again, I had mentioned that I would discuss Women in Kaddish tonight. I decided that since we had 2 weeks before the Pesach break, and Women in Kaddish would take me one shiur, I'd rather do a topic that will take me two shiur, and then we'll go for the Pesach break, and then we'll come back on the Women in Kaddish. So that's what these shiurs are for. Okay? Now, you were about to ask a question. You would ask a question about
Feminism? No, I was just going to say, I asked about
Feminism. Yes, what? What
do you want? Something unique that women to contribute if they don't have it. That we have so much left out of education in terms of contribution to the same.
What's
it? No, anything.
Tell me anything you know.
Something good to women.
Mira,
Shira,
I'll tell you something. A couple of interesting halachot. I mean, what's an interesting feministic discussion? It has to do with not that everyone here is a feminist. There's an interesting problem having to do with the Arba Kosot, leaning with the Arba Kosot. The halacha is that the Arba Kosot are drunk as a sign of freedom. Matzah is eaten as a sign of freedom. Those things which are signs of freedom, one has to act out the freedom. And the way we act out is by leaning. So the halacha states that that when you drink the Arba Kosot, you have to drink them leaning. You lean, okay? Essentially, you lean on your left side, you eat with your right hand, you lean on your left side, and you drink. There's a discussion in the Gemara about whether women lean or not. Poskim said that women didn't leave because she was in awe of her husband. And that since she was in awe of her husband, that that fear, that awe, that fear, that awe, is contrasts with the concept of leaning. Just as a Talmud does not lean in front of his teacher, his Rebbe, so the wife does not lean in front of her husband. The Ramah, but it appears even earlier than the Ramah, says nowadays that's not so, because all our women are nashim, but the Gemara there says, an isha chashuva, an important woman, does leave. A woman who is important is all right. She's a woman who has tremendous wealth and inheritance. Husband's alone for the rock. She leans, because she's an isha chashuva. Says the Ramah, and Ramah's in the early, in the 1500s already, okay? And he's quoting sources that are earlier than that. States, kol hanashim shelanu chashuvot. The Ramah says, all women are chashuvot, which would immediately lead you to the conclusion that what?
Oh, women
lean. Not only are they lean, they're obligated to lean. You understand? If you're obligated, if you drink the arba kosot without doing the full act, without leaning, you have to do it again. So not only can you lean, you have to lean. Okay? It can be worse than burn. So that's what the Ramah says, none of our wives lean. The man says, I'm makpika lean. The women are not makpika lean. So he said that he quotes an interesting, there's a view of the Rav Yah. The Rav Yah states that leaning was, the whole concept of leaning was to show dabini, to show that you, you know, really don't care about anybody. The kings used to lean. Everybody's seen a Cecil B. DeMille movie. You know, they lean, dancing girls, and you know, dropping the grape. They lean. That's how they ate.
The Greeks leaned.
The Romans leaned. Sure, everybody they leaned. That's how they had. They leaned with that small tables in front of them, and they leaned. You know, like you're watching television, and you're on the couch and eating stuff. That's how they ate. So says the Rav Yah. In the Middle Ages, by the time of the Middle Ages, he says, we don't lean. It's considered, you know, boorish to lean. Sit up and eat at the table. Kings don't lean. Kings nowadays sit straight in tall chairs and they don't lean. So therefore, the whole concept of tefasava is counterproductive. You want to lean to show that you're a king. Nobody, you know, kings lean. Kings sit up straight. Actually, it happened with the King Arthur and the Round Table. I mean, that became a sign. They were sitting up and eating bait with their fingers, but they did sit up. Sitting in chairs. So the Rav Yah says that our women rely on the view of the Rav Yah, and nowadays nobody has to lean, either men nor women. Avadi Yosef, however, states very clearly that he believes women have to lean. She says, look, the men, we don't rely on Rav Yah. Okay, we, the men, lean. She says, the men lean, and the women have to lean. Because kol hanashim shelanu chashuvot. But the Ramah said that women don't lean, and they rely on Rav Yah. And the truth of the matter is that nowadays, if you don't drink with leaning with the first two cups, you have to repeat it again. But after the meal, if you don't lean, the halacha is that you probably don't lean. Probably don't repeat it again, because in there we rely on Rav Yah, and there's a question being called Mosifa Lekosot. I don't want to get to the whole halachic gymnastics. To some extent, we do lean. Anyway, if you'd like to lean, you're more than welcome to lean. But in fact, if you have a leaning tendency, you really should lean. Because okay, now there's an interesting discussion of Gemara about leaning. The Gemara said that when we kiavina beit Rav, in the house of Rav, he says even though a student is not supposed to lean in front of his teacher, Rav said we should go ahead and lean. His mother said we should go ahead and lean. So the Gemara says that they were sitting on the floor. They were sitting on the floor. It wasn't enough. So they're sitting on the floor. So they said each one leaned on the foot of the person next to it. So of course, what's the question? Who did the last guy lean on? So what's the answer?
Circle.
Exactly, a circle. Or he leaned against the wall. No, he leaned up against the wall, and that was not a problem. So if you want to know who to lean on, I don't know. You can lean on the table, you can lean on the back of the chair. We normally sit, my father always says what we call a hesed. We used to always call it a hesed bed. I said, what's a hesed bed? Now, as if it was spelled H-E-S-S-E-B-E-D. No, it's not. It's a hesed bed. With a hasava, right? It's a hesed bed, and he has like two or three chairs together, and he really means like a Roman. But I'm more modernistic of us, more actually lean on the back of the chair, lean on the table. Okay, very comfortable. Okay. Alrighty. Now, so what I'd like to do start today is to deal with the subject of Kfutzot, Tfilah Nashim, women's prayer groups. This is remotely related to the issue of the women by the Kotel. Maybe we'll have a chance, we'll talk about that particular issue as well. I think it should be very clear. We saw that while women are obligated in private prayer, they're not obligated in public prayer, which essentially means that women should be able to do what they want to, right? I mean, they don't have to come to shul. They can stay home. They can essentially do what they want to. And again, we know that when it comes to tefillah b'tzibur, since women are not obligated in tefillah b'tzibur, they can't form a quorum for the tefillah b'tzibur. It doesn't mean they don't form a minyan at all. We saw that for a variety of things, they do form a minyan, whether obligated equally, whether especially for suminisa. And we saw that women count for minyan by Megillah, Kiddush Hashem, Birkat HaGomel, Brit Milah, lighting Hanukkah candles in the shul. But generally speaking, the running of the shul, the day-to-day actions in the shul, are exclusively male-oriented. And even though women can be active in their passivity, what I mean to say is like most men in shul are passive. I mean, you have a couple of bali tefillah, you have a couple of people getting aliyah. So even the vast majority of people, when they come to shul, are passive, but they're active in their passivity. And women can be that too. I mean, you know, we get out from a hearing about, what do you mean active? They say, oh, he's a terrible cousin. If I were in the daven, I'd daven better. Or he was a terrible about, he didn't know how to lane, he made a mistake, same mistake. If I were to lane, I would do better, etc., etc. I mean, it's the kibbutzing quality. It makes me active in my passivity. But the fact of the matter is, I'm passive. The truth of the matter is that most women who sat on the other side of the mechitza were passive in the passivity. What do I mean by that? They never thought of themselves as being shlichei tzibur, or never thought of themselves saying, if I were to get up before the omelet, this is how I would daven better. I would have sung this melody. Because it was such a beyond their experience. They didn't do it. But women rarely said.
We can't have a
female,
we do.
Yes, you do. However, and most women, except maybe my mother-in-law who knows how to lane, would say, would say, if I were to the lane, I would have done it this way. I didn't know how to set the drop. He said the words all wrong. Because generally speaking, most women didn't know how to lane. Didn't know how to lane. They barely knew how to set new drop. Maybe some enlightened teacher taught them what an etnachta was, a munach was, where there are stops in halacha, in the text. But essentially, how to set the words, most women didn't know how to lay. Even when it came to Mikra Megillah, which are obligated, women didn't learn in the Mikra Megillah, and most women didn't lay because there was a very rare need for the situation to occur. And it was also very clear that as you move into the 1900s, as you move towards the 1970s, where women are now taking leadership roles in the secular world at large, making million-dollar decisions, serving as professors, serving as neurosurgeons, leading serving as equal partners in all aspects of secular life, there was a dissatisfaction that was building that came to religious life. Now, it's a great generalization, I say some, because many, many women, I would even argue the majority, vast majority of women, are perfectly happy with the roles that they were in. They didn't want to have to get up and worry about getting up early, and they were relieved the fact they didn't have to prepare a parsha for the bat mitzvah, and that they were perfectly happy to supplement these needs in different directions. They were happy to accept, they found tremendous fulfillment in a traditional role. There was nothing wrong with it. On the contrary, in Jewish tradition, such a traditional role was lauded. But I don't think we can hide the fact that there were women who were clearly dissatisfied, who complained a great deal. And there's a very beautiful give and take between the wife of the Netziv and the Baruch Epstein, who wrote the Torah Tanima. He has an autobiography, the four volume autobiography called Makom Baruch. And in this, it's Baruch Amin Epstein. And he, in this autobiography, he has a discussion with the wife of the Netziv. By the way, this discussion, which is full of emotion and pathos and anger, was translated in a book that's called My Uncle the Netziv. This particular section of the Makor Baruch was translated in a digest form. The problematic areas were essentially either deleted or, how would I say, abridged, mollified, softened, glossed over. This book was done about 4 years ago. Translation about 4 years ago. It caused a tremendous ruckus in the community. Where the Aguda wing, it was done by Arsenal. And the Aguda wing said, how'd you even publish, which she said, some of what she said. They were angry that even that was published.
So
and of course the tradition.
My aunt for the tape.
No, that's the joke, I told you. Did you remember that? Okay, this is the book my uncle for the tape. So they tell the story about, you know, remember that it says that Lot's wife was told not to turn back, and she turned back,
yeah.
And she turned into a Netziv Melech, a pillar of salt. Well, some say that there's a new book coming out by the daughters of Lot, and it's going to be called My Mother the Netziv. Anyway, My Uncle the Netziv is a translation of the Makor Baruch, but in this discussion, you have, it must be about 15, 16 years old, and he's having a discussion with his aunt, the wife of the Netziv, I forgot her name, it escapes me. And there's a tremendous amount of pathos in that discussion where you see that she was not happy with the traditional role. She was a highly educated woman. And she essentially said, you know, in this family in Volozhin, everything is Torah. If you don't learn Torah, if you don't know Torah, you're nothing. And what am I supposed to say? Am I nothing? And she starts talking about, and she's the woman who sat and learned all the time. But she didn't have access to the traditional sources, so all the Gemara she knew came from the Sanhedrin or a secondary source. She's a highly illiterate woman, and she is having these arguments back and forth. Baruch Levy Epstein sort of sloughs her off in an immature fashion. He's totally insensitive to this woman's pain, and he talks about how years later, his insensitivity, he does tshuva for his insensitivity. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece appears in the Makor Baruch. In any case, there's no question that as we move into the 70s, particularly because women see that women are getting more and more educated. In the 70s, there are schools opening up for higher education for women, Jewish education. And women are going, you know, it's not simply Stern, but you can go to Drisha, you can go to Bravender's, you can spend years learning Gemara. You can get a very, and all this higher education that's available in the States, certainly in Eretz Israel is one of the pioneers for education for women. And women are now, the doors, the sources, to the knowledge is opening up, and to some extent, this really heightens some of the women's frustration, not lessens it. I mean, I I think that, again, you have to be very careful with the generalization. Many, many women are perfectly happy with their role. But there were a large percentage of the women who were unhappy and did not like a passive role in the synagogue. And in the early 70s, in the early 1970s, there were a group of women who actually broke with tradition. They were traditional women, but they broke with tradition. They started, I wouldn't call it egalitarian, but it was a women's minion. They counted 10 women for a minion, and they started davening with the from a Sefer Torah. It's essentially egalitarian without the men. These were, and a group started in Washington, D.C. in the early 1970s. And there are a variety of groups that started. Some of the women actually broke away from conservative Judaism, but others that wanted to remain traditional had these all-female services. Others felt that you couldn't do that. I mean, that was a clear break with tradition. You study, you know, that comes to Tefillah B'Tzibur, women don't come from Tefillah because they're not high in Tefillah B'Tzibur. And they can't do all those things that require a minyan. Nevertheless, they would do, they would get together to daven shacharit or mincha. And let me just sort of describe to you what these women did. First of all, what was the motive? A lot of these women, let me describe what they did, and we'll talk about motivation here. What these women did was that they would do a shacharit. And how do they do it? They did the shacharit as follows. They would, sukkah zimra, no, brachot, sukkah zimra is no problem. You get to Kaddish before Boruch Hu, you skip it. Boruch Hu you can't say because you need a minute, you skip it. But you have a chazanit, and she's plowing through the davening. Now you get to the Shmona Esrei, there are two variations. One is you do Tfilah B'Lahash, and there's no Chazaret Hashatz. Alternatively, the woman who didn't daven, the one who was the chazanit, didn't daven the first time, and she would daven the second time out loud. Now, davening out loud is not trivial, because Shmona Esrei is supposed to daven privately, but there are some sources for the ability to daven out loud if it inspires others to daven with more kavana. There's more mystical objections than halachic objections to davening out loud. If it gives you greater kavana, we know on Rosh Yom Kippur, for instance, people very often daven more out loud. Of Soloveitchik, when then Rosh Yom Kippur would really daven, you could really hear of Soloveitchik daven, if you daven not far from it. And again, there were a lot of justifications. It was not really anti-halachic, the davening out loud. So this woman would daven essentially her private Shmona Esrei out loud. There was no recitation of Kedusha, no recitation of Kedusha, because you need that's a really a minyan concept. There was some suggestion, if you look at some of the old Sidurim, this doesn't appear in the United States, but look at old Sidurim, for a person who davened alone, there were selections in which you could say, this is what you say, and you find like the old Tefillah Shalem, or the Mincha Yerushalayim, some of the big Sidurim, the old classic Sidurim, right after Asher Valetzion, you'd see sections that essentially had, this is what you say if you miss Boruch. This is what you say if you miss Kedusha or Kaddish. And what these were selections from Midrashim, selections from Nevi'im, which you would essentially say as part of Navi, as part of the Midrash, as part of the Zohar, without actually doing it as part of your Tefillah B'Tzibur, but as the learning. But you would essentially say the same selections. Now came the problem of Kriyat Torah. What do they do for Kriyat Torah? Again, there were a variety of variations. One variation was that they would take out the Sefer Torah and read. They would read from the Sefer Torah. They might even have aliyot. They would call up Bat Kohen, Bat Levi, Bat Yisrael, or they would do it in any order, because essentially the concept of Kohen Levi Yisrael is relevant. They claimed this was learning Torah, not an aliyah, but they would, essentially a woman would prepare, they would say there was a mimicry of what went on in the men's service. But according to the first variation, they didn't say brachot, because the brachot required a minyan. In the second variation, and we'll have to discuss this, there was a psak given by Avi Weiss, based on Saul Berman's interpretation of the Masachet Sofrim, which is at the taken face value at the moment, we'll discuss it, who suggested, yes, they could say the brachot, provided they didn't say brachot. They could actually say the same brachot, before and after, that a man would say when he got the aliyot, without brachot. Because brachot is a clear davishut of dusha, but the brachot, not necessarily davishut of dusha. Now, very quickly, I will show you that this is definitely wrong. This is definitely wrong, it's a misunderstanding. But since if you're going to study the sugya, you have to see, you have to understand why it's wrong and what's the problems with it. Many, many, I would say, the vast majority of the women's prayer groups, I would say the majority, not that, the majority of women's prayer groups do say bracha. It's clearly wrong, it's really a bracha of bakalot. And when we get into the bakalot, I'll show it to you right away why it's wrong. There are several groups in Skokie and in Newton. If insulted me on the issue, they don't make brachot at all. It'd be the first variation, which they don't say. There is a third variation. The third variation says the brachot of limud haTorah before they read the Torah. This is, which tells you the brachot that we would say in the morning, Asopit Devei Torah, Varevna, Shabbat Habanu, they would not say it in the morning, and they would reserve it before they said it, before they got their personal, quote-unquote, aliyah, or they are called to learn. How that works is not trivial at all. How it can be done, we'll talk about that too. Okay? I'm just saying those are the variations of what to do brachot. There is a, okay, now for those groups that don't say brachot, some of them do some other things. Hey, say special tefillah. In one group that consulted with me, I suggested they say a pasuk from Tehillim. Which goes as follows. It's in Kuf Yutet. Kuf Yutet has every letter mentioned 8 times. Each verse begins a letter. I suggest they say the pasuk that appears in Kuf Yutet a little bit. Baruch Ata Adonai Lamdei Chukecha. Now that's a pasuk in Tehillim. You can say it. In fact, the halacha says you should say it. You say Baruch Ata Hashem, and you realize, I already made that bracha, or I didn't. So they say, you finish off by saying, Lamdeni Chukecha, because that's a pasuk in Tehillim that's perfectly legitimate. And it's an appropriate pasuk in Tehillim to say, and it sort of sounds like a bracha, you know, missing the Lekeinu Melech Olam, it's not exactly, but it's, you know, it's appropriate. It's a pasuk in Tehillim dealing with learning, okay? There are other groups that wanted to say the bracha without using Hashem's name, okay? There are a variety of variations of it, but essentially you've heard the basic principle. And then that's how they would do Kriyat the Torah. The group that does it in Skokie spends a lot of time, what? I know more than you. In Skokie, there's a group, there's a women's prayer group in Skokie.
Ah, but you don't know what's going on in England, do you?
No. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Because I was involved in a group in London.
What? What is her name?
Who?
The wife of...
Pimpastelli.
What?
Wife of Pimpastelli.
Pimpastelli.
His wife?
Yeah.
She's... Okay, I don't want to get too much about
it. You said it already.
The situation, okay, so that's as far as the Kriyat HaTorah is concerned. The Haftorah, again, is the same sort of problem. I mean, if you said brachot, they would say brachot before the Haftorah too, which is clearly wrong. I keep repeating it.
No.
Okay, these groups, let me just finish what happens on Shabbat. And then they don't say Kaddish, Kedusha, they don't, but then they do Musaf the same way. And essentially, they do what they feel they can do within the halachic framework as far as the tefillah is concerned. Now, some of these groups don't meet on Shabbat because they feel that having a Shabbat service detracts from the sense of community. And they will therefore meet on a Shabbat mincha, when women don't normally come, or they'll meet on a Rosh Chodesh, which has a typical woman's element. The Gemara talks about the woman didn't work on Rosh Chodesh, and that was the reward for not getting involved in Chet HaEgel. In fact, the fourth aliyah that's given in Rosh Chodesh is supposed to be in memory of the women. It was made a Yom Tov because it was Yom Tov for the women. And see, if the women didn't work, the husbands couldn't make them. That's why it was a day off. Anyway, as far as motivation is concerned, there are various motivations for getting involved with women. Some of the women were clearly involved. It was a question of an agenda. They were viewing this as an evolution that they could force upon the halakha, and on their way to get bigger and better things. Because if you could get the movement large enough, then they would essentially try to force the halakha's hand, and then the halakha would be forced into declaring the tenure like a minion of some sort. But that was a minority. Although this group, as you read the article that I've distributed in Ecology, those of you get it, I'll give it to you, I'll make more copies next week. Unfortunately, a lot of these women who have that agenda appear in the leadership of the women's tefillah group, what's called the women's tefillah network. I should say also women would get together for their own hakafot, they would get together for Mekru Megillah, but that's more peripheral. We'll talk about hakafot, women's hakafot, and we'll also talk about Mekru Megillah we talked about. And I want to make it clear that Megillah reading is a totally different issue. As I pointed out last week when I talked about women's Megillah reading, there, the only reason why Poskim would view it problematically because it sort of comes on the heels of women's prayer groups. But if it were in a vacuum, most Poskim would say no problem whatsoever. When they're chayiv, you have to let them do it. And even the most vocal, vociferous, those who object most vociferously to a women's prayer group, very often said, yeah, women's Megillah reading, there's no problem. So it's really totally different. But women's hakafot, or a women's shachrit, or a mincha prayer, or Rosh Chodesh prayer, that is a separate issue. Now what was the motivation? Some of the women felt that it was a learning experience. And a lot of the early women's prayer groups justified it just that. They said, look, when I come to shul, I want to know what a good kriya is about. I want to know what a good nusach is. If I don't do it myself, if I don't learn the trap, and this is an opportunity, it's a learning experience. It would be the woman's an analogy to a junior congregation. Okay? But not in a pejorative sense. It would be an opportunity. It's a learning experience. Learning experience, by hands-on experience, I'll learn what trap is. I'll be forced to learn what trap is. How many women didn't learn the trap for Megillah until they were forced to read? Right? And that's they view that as a positive experience. So one justification is it's a positive a learning experience. Others felt that it gave them one of the things that bothered them by diving the other side of the machitza was that they were passive. Then they needed sort of mediators, men to be the intermediaries between them and a Kodesh Baruch Hu, because the men were leading service, the men were davening. They wanted a more active and meaningful involvement in the spiritual moments of prayer. Now, and I think when I talk to women involved, and I talk to hundreds of women, literally hundreds of women, because I'm interested in the motivation, because as you're going to see, motivation is a very crucial issue in the halakha determining process. Why? Because poskim will not support rebellion. If a woman is searching out for greater kavanah, to get closer to Kadosh Baruch Hu, poskim will mean, if the woman is genuine, poskim wanted to come as far as they want. But if they're trying to stick it to halakha, say, we're going to find any way possible to undermine halakha or to get around, that the halakha says will not support. Now when these women turned to the local Orthodox rabbinate, there were several responses. One response was that the rabbis were very sympathetic to the women's requests, tried to help them as much as possible, tried to give them halachic guidelines, and they were very supportive. Unfortunately, in the early days of women's prayer groups, The majority of rabbis that were supportive and got involved were not the, not the Gedolim. There was a rabbis who had very, very sensitive, very big hearts, great, wonderful human beings and leaders, but they were not always the Gedolim, the poskim. So essentially, by their getting involved, it's only almost made the whole issue a fringe element from the halakhic perspective. There are many other rabbis who were just very much against women's prayer groups for a variety of primarily social, public policy reasons, and also they put forth some halakhic reasons as well. The vast majority of women in women's prayer groups have been going on from around 1972 to the modern era. So we're talking about someone that's been around for about 27 years, okay, in different formats, in different groups, in different sizes. I don't think that we should think that the women's prayer, women's tefillah network, is an enormous. I think that if we had to ask, if I were to estimate how many women actually involved in women's prayer groups, I would say we're talking about somewhere around 400. Am I about right?
That's
400 women were actively involved.
All over the world? What are you talking about, all over the world?
All over the world.
It must be more than that. I mean, I know about 200 in England.
200?
Yes, because there are about 40 in the group that I was involved in Manchester. And there's at least 100 in London.
So let's push the number up to 600. I'll make the point. I wanted to give you 1,000.
Right.
Okay. I don't think it's 1,000, but I wanted to give you. I wanted to say 1,000. 1,000 is still a very small percentage of Jewish women. I mean, if a woman wants a woman's prayer group, I would say, in contradistinction to women's Megillah readings, I would say there are tens of thousands, hundreds, of that, all over. What? Oh, yes. Excuse me? First you ever heard of it? Who's been doing it? But when it comes to... Excuse me? Yes, no. Colombia has one. Certainly states. No, Israel's always about 10 years behind the States. And I would say, that as a general phenomenon, halachic women's lib, is not so. Women seem to have either that, because I would say that most revolutions, most changes are done by the leisure class, by the middle class. I mean, this is a general, for anybody who studied a little bit of economics and political science and history knows that the middle class is the one that leads these type of revolutions, because they have time. But
The poor are too busy being born.
I would say Israel, the life in Israel is much harder. And I would say that a woman comes up, she's tired.
Women have more leisure time.
But you have much less leisure time. And I would say that maybe if they're very much caught up in their teaching and the work and their careers, they have less of a need for it. Now, what's interesting in the States, I will tell you some other interesting observations that I made. It seems that there's a lot of interest in halacha. I would say there's a lot of interest in learning. And the Women's Feminist Conference, you'll have 2,000 women or 2,000 people showing up. Maybe a quarter of the women there are involved in women's prayer groups. The majority of women are interested sort of in the issues of feminism because they're in it for the Torah. And in fact, if you were to take a poll about what happens to the daughters of the women who are involved in women's prayer groups, it turns out that they're, for the most part, their daughters do not go to women's prayer groups. It's an interesting phenomenon, because their daughters don't view their future as chazaniyot, but rather as poskot. They view the way to the top through something that feels permanent. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik said it. Rav Soloveitchik, in a discussion of, and I will get into Rav Soloveitchik's view on women's prayer groups, Rav Soloveitchik says, you're wasting your time. It's a passing fad. It's not going to last. If you want to invest your time in improving women's status in halacha, it's through halacha. it's through learning Torah that you found some learning. And that's why the Soloveitchik taught the first Gemara Shir, and it's stern because he wanted to impress upon the women that that's what he thought the women should be doing. That's where the women should be moving up. As from women should be moving up, and that should be through Torah. If we were asked for Soloveitchik that a woman should get learn Torah, get involved in Torah, get even get involved in Pesach, I don't think Rav Soloveitchik would have had any problem with it. Now, the,
I mean, how do you define a woman's faith? For instance, Tachmoni, you know, they have, the boys go at 17
excellent.
To their minion, and the girls go, I don't know if they do it,
right.
The boys in Kitha Bet, but the girls clearly do something else.
Very good. In fact, one of the most outspoken opponents of women's prayer group said, Rav Menashe Klein, who's the Hungan Shavav in Borough Park, tremendous Talmud Chacham. He said, these women's prayer groups, it's our fault. We have these women serving as, girls serving as chazoniyot. They just took it as a natural extension. I think, and you'll see when I get to discuss Rav Soloveitchik, you'll see he makes the same distinction. It's one thing to have it within an educational institution where the goal is clearly educational. Okay? You want the girls to daven, you want the women, you want the girls to get be acquainted with the davening. Preferably they should go to a minyan, but if they can, as the way it was for many years with the girls in the fourth from the fourth grade and up, were all shy with the boys until there was problems developing with the furniture that was slowly being destroyed. No, Tachkam only paid a lot of money to all shy. And but all shy said it wasn't worth it. Just the damage that was being caused to the furniture was a major problem. And if you think we don't have a problem here with high school kids,
it's terrible.
I mean, it's a real problem. But we view it so far, we still view it as our contribution to Yeshiva and their own. But there's a major problem. Stickers and carvings. It hasn't been bad, by relatively speaking, it really hasn't been bad by what it could be. But Oshai suffered tremendously. And so therefore, but as far as when they say, look, we have to, it's part of our education, we have to teach these women to daven.
Right, because the girls view that the boys found a new show at the Oshai one. The boys moved over to a new show.
Without
an education.
It was limited. No, it wasn't because they wanted to exclude the girls. They wanted to limit it, have much more supervision and limit as much as possible. The fact of the matter is that the what I would say that the major problem occurred when the women's prayer groups started with Kriyat HaTorah. Because the Kriyat HaTorah then became no longer an educational experience, rather looked almost like it was radical. Because that was not something, I mean, women to get them davening and davening to do the personal prayer obligation, that's one thing. But take out the Torah, why are you taking out the Torah for? If it's not a mimicry of what's going on in the men's.
Why can't it be synonymous?
I'll explain to you why I use the word mimicry. Mimicry was a word that was actually introduced by Joel Wolowski. Joel Wolowski is if you think I'm feminist, you should say it. He unfortunately is not married, he's still eligible. Wonderful, wonderful. And he's very, just published a book on, I forgot the title of it. Joel Wolowski said one of the things that bothered him was that with the freedom that women had to do what they wanted, what did they say they wanted to do? They wanted to do just what the men were doing. You know, the halakha gives women freedom to do new things, to do things that are more meaningful. Yet the women.
I don't know.
If you want to maintain that you're taking out the Sefer Torah as a limud haTorah, learn Torah.
Why take out
a chumash? And this is Rabbi Jacobus. We'll talk about Rabbi Jacobus. Says, if you want to learn Torah, take out a chumash. Why not be taking a Sefer Torah?
Why should it be
asked?
Why they can't?
Who said that? Why Dafka do it?
Well, why not Dafka? What's the problem?
What's your goal in mind? I'm playing devil's advocate.
volunteers can stop it, right?
What?
Certainly Ms. Garrett with other women.
So stop it!
Okay, and to your friends, stop. From
why? Why are you putting the dough?
Why not? I don't understand the question, Nicole.
If we were here to get the dough every week, why shouldn't they give it?
Why shouldn't they
have it? Without the women.
Right, what's it?
The women who mock people here.
So you want, but no, but if you want to create the dough, so they're going to chumash you.
But people felt that the Sefer Torah has more kiddush.
It has more kiddush.
And Mukdasha, and therefore it felt like you were achieving something more from it.
Okay.
And it probably worked.
That argument, okay, that particular argument is valid provided you prove it.
Okay.
There's one woman. Unfortunately, there's one woman in this audience who's already read my article, so she knows where I stand.
If
she's
you look
sitting
at
over there. Anyway, that argument has validity. But you have to demonstrate. You have to demonstrate that a personal feeling, a person who wants to learn, who wants to do Steinmaker of the Chatan, wants to learn how Shara Rabba Knight, can go ahead and take out a Sefer Torah because he feels there's a greater sense of Kedusha. And that's perfectly legitimate. I'll tell you one good reason not to take it out. And that is because we don't play with Sefer Torah. When we go to schools, we don't take out a Sefer Torah and say, has greater Kedusha. Everyone, whip out your Sefer Torah. We don't say that. Excuse me, I didn't say it. I'm saying, for regular Torah study, we don't do such things. We don't do such things because we say that in order to maintain the Torah, but it's not trivial because there is a view of the Prisha, the Shach, who holds, no, you can't take out a Sefer Torah. If a bar mitzvah boy, for instance, wants to practice his truck, it's not clear that you can take out a Sefer Torah. We don't pass it that way. He was a tikkun. But very often, if you stop wants to practice learning from reading from the Torah, you don't do those type of things. You don't stop taking a Sefer Torah to learn. You want to stop and learn, you take out a chumash. Because the Torah, you don't move the Torah unless it's absolute, a public the Torah unless it's absolute.
Okay, but you see, but as soon as you use the word stam, as soon as you use the word stam, you minimalize the validity of the woman's prayer.
No, I said the kriya.
Stam
means it's not a bona fide halachic kriya. That's what stam means. Stam means stam learning limud haTorah. Okay, stam limud haTorah. But when do you take out a sefer Torah according to the view of the shach and the prisha? You take out a sefer Torah when it's a bona fide kriya to Torah. If it's not a bona fide kriya to Torah where Torah is necessary, then chumash mula Torah. It stems from the sanctity of the Torah. The statement that you made, that I as an individual feel greater sanctity in learning the Torah. My limud of Torah will be more meaningful. It's something that I have to demonstrate is valid. And the answer is yes, you can demonstrate that that's valid. But we'll have to go to the sources to see that is the truth. Yes.
Doesn't it seem that you must take out the Torah scroll photos. It sinks to the level of mimicry because the men take out Monday, Thursday, and Shabbat. Then you have to.
That's Joel's argument, the question of motivation.
Am I
really taking out the state of the Torah? Because
don't misunderstand. I am.
I understand it.
I am a pro feminist.
You would never.
I'm sorry. But. However, not every argument that can be put forward is honest. Not every argument, when I feel a greater kedusha, that's why I'm doing it. Maybe not. Maybe the reason why I'm doing it is because I really want to mimic. I want to show that women can do it too. That's why I want to do it. Because I want to show that women can do it too. I justify it by saying it's a greater kedusha. The question is what?
No, but there's something that you or anybody else can actually say. I think there's a motivation between a woman and a kaddish bracha. What they do with the top is motivation.
But as the posek has to deal with the different questions, I have to make a decision based on that. Because that's a halakha consideration.
What you're saying is if it's not you, then it's a misra.
I'm saying that according to the prisha and the shach, exactly right. It's not chiyuv, it's an isra. Because nowadays when we have chumashim, and if you want to learn Torah, it's not necessary to take a Sefer Torah.
Well, it's not necessary in the middle of davening for neighbor, is it?
Why of course, how are you can't get it.
They're
obligated,
they can't read it from a chumash.
It's not, can they brachas in a chumash? Can they brachas in a chumash? So, the Haftorah is a special issue, why we can read the Haftorah not from the cloth. And in many shuls, they do read the Haftorah from the cloth. It's not clear why the Haftorah. Maybe that was a special takana by Haftorah, not Nachash. Okay, I'm not nullifying your argument. I'm saying, and one of the reasons why I gave out this article on women of halacha and feminism, because I want you to read the critique. You have to think honestly. You have to think fairly. And you have to evaluate that which you're saying is really true. It may be a valid argument. Is that really the true reason? Let me give you an example, a very interesting story, which I was planning to tell later by Rav Soloveitchik. A woman came to Rav Soloveitchik and said that she wanted to wear a talis. Wanted to wear a talis. So Rav Soloveitchik said, fine, I'll let you wear a talis, but I want you to wear it for the first 3 weeks without tzitzis. No, we can actually wear 4-quarter garments without tzitzis. I want you to come back and report to me when you're diving with the talis without the tzitzis. I want you to tell me what you feel. She came back three weeks later. She asked her, what did you feel? She said, I felt a tremendous sense of exhilaration. I felt I was wrapping myself up. And I felt a wonderful sense of a religious high. So Soloveitchik actually said, do you realize, of course, that there was no keem of any mitzvah? Because the mitzvah is with the tzitzis on. You didn't do it, and yet you had what you believe was a more spiritual moment. Okay? The question is, essentially, was this merely a placebo effect? Okay? The question was, are you really getting a spiritual high? Is there really how can there be a spiritual high if there's no true keem on mitzvah? So Rav Soloveitchik, one of the fundamental elements was Kiyum HaMitzvah. Okay? Am I getting a greater Kiyum HaMitzvah? And this wearing the talis and feeling you're wearing this talis, didn't have a tzitzis, it says, that's a placebo effect. You're drawing on a psychological effect. Now, one can say, oh, he played a trick card. Okay? But the fact of the matter is, Rav Soloveitchik wanted the Kedusha to stem from a greater Kiyum HaMitzvah. So to be very careful, what exactly is analyzing what really is going on.
Surely the point is the feeling of Kedusha comes in both directions. It comes from inside of you and how you feel about what you're doing and what you're doing it with, as well as from the other direction down towards you. And so what she was getting was the feeling that she felt as though she was doing something in a better way.
Yeah, but there was clear no...
Okay, there was nothing...
Especially after he told her to do it.
No, he doesn't. Sure, she's just a woman who knows but she told her, let's just tell me what you feel.
Excuse me,
yeah.
I would like to ask you. What happened to this lady with her exhilaration without the
exhilaration?
She had the exhilaration. I'm asking, I don't know what happened.
What happened was, inside her head, that the feeling of holiness and really kavana from Davina. Rabbi Shapira from Lublin said, that the governing of women is more accepted by Rabboni Shel Olam because it's warmer, because there is more emotion in it, because the woman by nature is a more emotional being. And the men are concentrating on daven, daven schnell.
That's the same whether they have a piece of square material around them or not.
And the commenting that women are better than men, you know where I stand. However, you did say something that I think is crucial. And we'll have to talk about this. The element of Kabbalah. That what this woman felt wrapped up in the talis may not have been Kiyum HaMitzvah, which is what Soloveitchik wanted her to feel. She felt greater focus, greater kavana, greater devotion. It's no different than putting on a girdle, or a special talis, or doing something, getting dressed up for davening, which helps us focus and gives a greater kavana, greater commitment. That may be what she felt, right? And that may be a very valid point. We have to talk about the value of kavana. Okay. It's interesting, and my brother Dov and I point this out in the article that we wrote, that in this particular case, Rav Soloveitchik did not say, what about greater kavana? Right? He feels that the limits to the halachic validity of kavana, we have to talk about this. We have to talk about how much does Kavanah allow me to do? How that does how what you know what priorities does Kavanah have priority over other certain things? Yes.
I think we're missing. I mean, I see it in the sources here, but maybe this whole plan that, I mean, till now we talked about mitzvah that women don't have to do but can do. And here suddenly, you know, while you were talking over the weeks, I leaped ahead in the book, there's some special cases.
The woman can't, don't do
should, that. Right, maybe we understood the special cases better.
The only two cases I would review, the only two cases are citizen trials. Those are the only two cases. And tefillin has to do with the fact that men, because she allowed men to wear tefillin, right? Tefillin is essentially wearing a sefer Torah all the time. It's also best that I die. That's Kip Kat. You always remember that you're wearing it. You can't be distracted. And it's also to have pass gas. It's also to have any bodily needs. You have to make sure you get in the tefillin immediately. You have to be careful what words you say. And the halacha, there was a time in the golden period they didn't allow men to wear tefillin. That they didn't allow. Men stopped wearing tefillin in the golden period. They felt they couldn't meet this ideal of what tefillin, what wearing the tefillin on you at all time was. They stopped wearing tefillin. Rav Haggai makes a strong letter. You got to wear tefillin. Just wear it during davening Shabbos. Okay? Because at least you're davening, if you concentrate, only to do that, just do that. What is it that the halacha that Rav has said, as it develops, we'll have to see it. The bottom line for the modern period, the way that modernist post can understand is, the men, because she are allowed to wear tefillin, only let them wear it for Shabbos. Why should the women put themselves in this? They're not obligated. Maybe because she let them wear tefillin. Why should women wear tefillin? In fact, Allah states that women should not wear tefillin. Okay? When it comes to tzitzis, that is a different issue. If a woman wants to wear talis, cut them. Okay? Most postman hold it's not a problem. Provided it's something that she would be feminine. Talit katan, underneath the man. What? With a bracha. Ashkenaz and bracha sparring. Okay? I didn't say they do. I said if they do, problem with bracha depends on Ashkenaz and Sfarim. However, if she wants to wear talit katan, no problem. The problem with the talit gadol, it comes in the category of yuhara. You are showing off. What are you showing off? Men are obligated in most in the mitzvot asay shazman gama. Women can assume upon themselves. Tzitzis, if you think about it, you're not obligated unless you wear a four-cornered garment. So even men are not obligated. We don't wear four-cornered garments. I mean, even a garment like this has four corners, but it really doesn't because it's rounded. Okay? And most of our shirts, they have four corners, right? And you need to be four or five corners, four or more. They're all in the front. And it has to be a situation where it's two in the front and two in the back. So if I didn't wear a talit katan, I would be chayav in tzitzit. Why do men wear talit katan? They're obligated, they're putting on a garment which obligates them in tzitzit, so they'll be able to do the mitzvah, but they're not up. But mitzvah din, some say it's a banan. It's pretty clear that it's a long-standing custom to wear a talit katan in order to make yourself obligated in the mitzvah. Otherwise, you wouldn't be obligated. Okay? So for a woman, to do that which even men are not obligated to do, is considered, the postman say, you are showing off. No, because once they wear the four-quarter garment, then they're obligated. A woman who wears a poncho or four-quarter garment, even then she can't obligate. So that's the, sort of the double step on this, okay? So that's what the postman say, if it's showing off, don't show off. That's why if you're wearing talit katan, you're not showing off. And there's no objection, because it's more underneath your garment. Okay, the postman talked about Marie Brona's wife who wore talit katan, many, many righteous women. We know that they were known to wear from family members. They were known to wear the talit katan. But talit gadol is considered shalach, but it's halacha doesn't object. Tefillin, halacha says, mokin ba. There was the famous, the maid of, the moid was called the moid of, there was a woman who was in the early 1900s who was in Europe. She, the famous story, she really wanted, there's a movie about it. Ludmilla, the maid of Ludmilla, who played, there's a famous woman actor, what's her name? Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
She played it with the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's based on fact, as Hollywood can be. But there's this woman, this Moira Ludwig, they have her going to America, but it's essentially, she ended up in Eretz Yisrael. She ended up in Eretz Yisrael, and she had a lot of Hasidim, and she had people who followed her, because she was a very extremely righteous woman. She came to Eretz Yisrael, she wore a Talis and Tefillin, and they told her, take off the Tefillin. And since she continued work, but the talis, they told her, the tefillin, they told her to take off. He said, halacha says smoking, you don't, we kosher men do it. Those are the only two cases.
Rashi's daughters wore tefillin as a widow.
There's no such source. We know that the wife, the Or Chaim, wore tefillin. You know, Michal Bat Shaul spoke traditionally wore tefillin. There are women through Jewish who wore tefillin, but they were clearly unique. They were very rare women. But it depends on different levels of sanctity. I don't know exactly what the story was. But as a public policy, the only mitzvah that we tell women that they, it's also for them to do, we object to it, is to.
But again, I think that's why it's
also.
It's
also because we let men work. Because it's because of the special sanctity that tefillin require, okay, men who are obligated, we say you can wear it for a limited time. Women, they're not looking objective to them.
So it's well for
them to the postmen say you have to be, that's right, there's a general policy, we don't let them. There are several, but they're unique. And how many are there in the whole world, right? Five people I can mention who work for them all day? These are people who are Rashi Yeshiva, who are involved in Clay Giller, they're involved in Kedusha all the time, they don't go out of the house, they stay in the base medrash the whole time. These are very special individuals, but as a general policy, men put on tefillin once a day. Okay. Phew, not making very practice at all. But I trust it's been fascinating. Okay, it's going to take more than 2 shiurim. Okay, so let me now. I think that it's very clear that having passed 27 years, and it's really not a passing fad, that women's prayer groups have held on, the poskim are now beginning to take it a little more seriously, especially since women have begun to flex their muscles in the sense of being much more vocal and much more verbal. There are essentially three fundamental approaches to the subject of women's prayer groups. One, the first and the most lenient position, maintains that women can carry out a full service, including all rituals, essentially say all done, all the math thing, Dvarim Shem Kedusha with a mini heart. There is such a shita. It's a shita of Goren, and which he later retracted, but we'll talk about it at great length. It's a very fascinating shita. It's a very fascinating shita. The second school is the more stringent school, that's actually represented by the Rosh Yeshiva Ritz and Menashe Klein, David Feinstein, David Cohen, and probably the other poskim, who came out of Laos, from Laos' office, who maintained that a women's prayer group is for women. You simply should not do it for a host of halachic and sociological reasons. The final approach argues that women's prayer service, if properly performed, is in accordance with halacha, although there is in this group, some who say that it's not good for the Jews. As a public policy grounds, they object to it.
Wait, on what point?
Well, we have already had like four variations. Give me some time. Okay. So let's now, what I'd like to do now is at least begin with the first school, which is the school of Rav Goren. Before we get to Rav Goren, I'd like to go through some sources. We won't do Rav Goren directly, but because it's already 20 to 10. But what I'd like to do with you, because this whole sugya is really very, extremely, extremely fascinating. Let's learn some sources. The first source, number one, we've already met. That's the famous Mishnah that says what requires a mikvah. Okay? Ein, source number one. Ein tolsin al shema ve'ein ovrim lefnei teiva. You don't say Baruch Hu and the Baruch Hu Kriya Shema, Kaddish and Baruch Hu and the Baruch Hu Shema. Vein ovrim lefnei teiva. You don't set up a chazan for the Zot HaShatz. Vein osin et kapehen. You don't do Birkat Kohanim. Ve'ein kohin ba'torah, ve'ein maftirin b'navi. You don't do kriyat ha'torah or the reading of the navi. Ve'ein osin mamad u'moshav. You don't do something what I call the funeral halls. Ve'ein omrim birkat avelim, b'tanchumi avelim. You don't do the birkat avelim, which was done when they came back from the Beit HaKvarot. What they did was I mentioned as we discussed women in minyan. They used to have a suda, and they used to say 9 cups of wine, and they used to. And comfort, and they would mention the praise of the comforters, and talk about the mourners, and talk about the seal. Okay, and they also didn't do tanchumi avin, which is a shura. Ubirket chatanim, you don't do sheva brachot. Ve'en mezamin b'shem, you don't say nevarech alupenu pachot me'asara, less than 10. So all these things mentioned in this list require me.
About the
other
limbs. Well, say that it's a family which only has girls
in
the family, and there's no male to mourn. Why
wouldn't
they do it for them?
Who says they don't do it?
Oh, okay.
No, I said you need a minion.
Ah.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if you hear when you discuss a minion, but in this particular case, it's an interesting question. I haven't dealt with it, but it would seem to me if you need 10, right? The question is whether you need 10 men. Okay, so the first things on the list, which are Dvarim, Shep, and Dusha, which are things that involve the prayer, public prayer, there you need males to be gathered. But for instance, the Shura, when we're chayvin, Yichom HaVelim, it might very well be, if you only had 10 women, you'd still be chayvin to do a Shura. Yeah, that might very well be true. All right. Now what I'd like to do is, because Kriyat HaTorah is probably one of the most problematic issues in a women's prayer group, let's read now the Rambam, source number 2, how the Rambam rephrases this Mishnah. Okay? The Ketzad hi tefilat ha-tzibur. What is this public prayer? Ye echad mitpalel b'kol ram v'kol shom'im. Okay? The way the Rambam has it, is the way many of the Sfaradim do it to this day, is that one person gets up and he davens for the community. Shrei tzibur davens for the community. It makes a lot of sense in a system where most people were illiterate. And the reason why we would have tefillah b'tzibur is so that he could daven for the community. Okay? Nowadays, the Ashkenazim follow a position where only those who are illiterate listen, and the Chazan only, since the vast majority, since we have Sidurim, so even if you don't know how to daven, you can read. You can read in Hebrew, you can read in English, and you can daven for yourself. So we sort of, except for Shmon Esrei, which Chazal said to say the whole thing out loud, what we do in the Birkot Kriya Shema, we say the beginning and the end. The beginning and the end. Ketusha we do together out loud, or something like that. The Kaddish Kadosh in the Birkot Kriya Shema. We do that out loud, but essentially we do the beginning and the end so that you're at least you fulfill the minimum of what's required for saying a bracha. Because if you have to say a bracha, the halacha is, if you said the beginning, the bracha of Hashem in the beginning, a little bit of the text, and the bracha at the end, you were yotze. That's essentially what our chazanim do for the Birkot Kriya Shema. So he says, one davens and the rest listen. Ve'ein osin kein pachot mi'asaran gedolim, v'necho, you need 4, 10 adults, and 3. V'shaliach tzibur echad me'en, the minyan v'shaliach tzibur counts. V'afilu ayu miktzatan shekfar palalu v'yatsu yidecho v'tan, even if a portion of that is essentially up to 4, even if a portion of them are already davened, mashlimim lehem la'asara, v'hu shiyah rov ha'asara shalui palu. Provided that in order for there to be a chazan, you need at least 6, the majority, and the other 4 can add on. V'chein ein omrim kedusha, v'lo korim b'torah, u'mevochim lefaneh u'lachareha, v'lo maftirim b'navi, ala v'asara. There's also, you don't read from the Torah or say the Haftorah, but that's not what he says. That's not all he says. What does he add at the end here that's different from what the Mishnah says? He says, V'lo korim b'Torah u'mevochim lefaneh l'achreah. and make the bracha before and after. Rambam adds that, if you look very carefully, he didn't merely restate the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, you don't read the Torah without Torah. He says, no, no, you don't read the Torah with the bracha before and after. So look at the Kesef Mishnah writes. Kesef Mishnah of Yosef Karo is an interpretation to the Rambam. Okay, the Kesef Mishnah at the bottom, what's underlined, source number three. The Katav Rabbeinu, the lo kohim batorah, umavachim lefaneh ulachareh, the ilu below bracha, because if it was to read the Torah without a bracha, pshita the mutav. Of course you can read. Pshita the mutav lekot. The ein maftirim benavi, nami hainu bivracha. There's no Easter, he says, to take a sacred Torah and read, says the Kesef Mishnah. What's the problem? You can't make the brachot. You can't make the brachot without a minyan. If an individual wants to take a sacred Torah, of course they can do that. By the way, it's very clear from this Kesef Mishnah that any argument whatsoever that you could make brachot before and after, he says, brachot lefanel, lacharet. I told you that in some of the women's prayer groups based on a psak, of Avi Weiss and Rav Saul Berman, that you could really make the bracha before. Well, I'll give you the analysis, but it's very clear that the Kesef Mishnah says that's not right. That's what the Mishnah came to answer. The Mishnah didn't say, what about Avi Weiss? Oh no, the only thing that's a problem is Baruch Hu. Does the Kesef Mishnah mention Baruch Hu? He says the bracha before and the bracha after. That's what the Mishnah is answering. Making brachot. Making the Kriyat the Torah brachot. Now let's look at source number four. The Prima Gadim. The Prima Gadim, again, is one of the major super commentaries. You know, I told you, on the Shulchan Aruch, you generally have two major, you have the text, which is the Shulchan Aruch, and usually the Ramah, or Moshe Ishulish, and the two major commentaries are in Aruch Chaim, for instance, in the Everyday Laws, is the Magen Avraham and the Taz. Okay? So these two major commentaries on the page, the Prima Gadim essentially wrote a super commentary on the two, showing their sources that he issued using. It's an outstanding piece of work, and he's really considered one of the major, major commentaries. He wrote also a commentary to the Talmud called the Rosh Yosef. And what does he say there? Vahad de'en korim b'Torah, that which the Megillah, the Gemara Megillah, states in the Mishnah. The enkovim b'Torah umaftir pachot misara, haynu mishum habracha. It's because of the bracha. Avo b'lo bracha, yicholin lotzi sefer Torah, v'likrot bo afilu pachot masara. He will ask it then. Yes, so the Prima Gadim, just like the Kesef Mishnah says, that any individual can take out a sefer Torah. V'chenu v'ramza, Ramoshe, we've been talking about the Rambam, Ramoshe zichrono levracha, Perchet milchot filah lechadalid, kumo shekatav hakesef mishnah sham, delo bracha pshita shemutar likrot pefachot lesara. Without a minyan, of course you can read from the Torah. You just can't make the brachot. Okay? And what are we referring to? Look what he says in the parentheses. Hainu b'sheni u'b'chamishi in the middle of the week, v'shabbat. Uchadoma, whenever the Torah is read. Avon ein mevochim afilu below barchu. You can't make the bracha even if you eliminate the barchu. Means he's anticipating what Avi Weiss and Berman say. No, the only thing darvish v'kedusha that requires a minyan is the barchu. He says nechdegetal. He says explicitly, it's not the barchu that's the only problem here. The bracha themselves are the problem. Afilu below Borchu, Rak Borch at Hashem Elkeinu Melech Olam Asu, Bepachot Me'asara. V'chein an Ein Maftirin Hanavi, Im Borch, Borchot Kama, referring to the Brachot. So what does the Mishnah come to forbid in the absence of a minyan? The reading of the Torah, or the Haftorah, with its Brachot. Without its Brachot, anybody can read. That's what the Kesef Mishnah clearly states here. That's correct. That is a direct contradiction to another view, which is the Shach and the Prisha, okay, who say, no, you can't stamp it. I agree. But the Shah, remember the Kesef Mishnah was before the printing press. Okay? The Prisha and the Shah are making their comment, clearly stating so, that we're making this halakha comment after the printing press. See, before the printing press, obviously the only way to learn Torah was take out the Chumash. Prisha and the Shah says, now that you've Chumashu, why? Stam, take out of the Torah to learn Torah. By Stam, take out of the Torah, you can take out a Chumash. It's a lack of respect. Now notice the Rosh Yosef, however, the Prima Gardin, is living in the 1700s. He's after the printing press. And yet he does repeat the Kesef Mishnah, nevertheless. So you see that the Rosh Yosef, the Prima Gardin, does not hold like the Prisha and the Shah. Okay?
People didn't copy the file on paper?
They did. They used to make Chumashim. It wasn't paper, they wrote on parchment.
Probably pretty rare.
Oh, excuse me, were there handwritten Chumashim? Yes, but they were extremely expensive. What made, look, for the same price as writing a book, you could write a Chatorah.
And even though
it got
it was
in
order
to write it, you have to write it without mistakes, you have to write it on the proper
plan. Right. And you can do illuminations, you can do other things, and then you can't do the Torah. That's correct. But the manuscripts, books were very expensive.
Even after the printing press, for the first 100 years or so, books were still very expensive.
I don't deny that. It's correct, because you didn't have them when mass produced. That's correct. All right, I suggest we do, we'll stop here. It's a good stopping point. We didn't get very far on the sources, but I think we did tackle one of the major questions about women reading the Torah. It seems, by the way, Avadi Yosef has a whole discussion about women, about not women, but an individual using the Sefer Torah, and he maintains an individual can take out the Sefer Torah. There's all the traditional Torah stuff that he does say. So, about your safe, but he says you can. But there are dissenting opinions, and we have to understand what the logic of the dissenting opinion is. Okay? Now, we'll meet next week. It looks to me like at the rate we're going, which is not very fast. And listen, really, This should be a no-holds-barred session, okay? I mean, if things bother you, pro or con, okay? Please express it, and I'll try to give you my humble opinion. In any case, I'd appreciate also if you read the article. Okay, I apologize again. Homework, yeah. I'll read the article, and at some point we'll just get to discuss it. It's high over.